This is Dave Chen, and this morning I'm speaking with writer Rich Shapiro, whose newest article, The Incredible Story of the Collar Bomb Heist, appears in the January 2011 issue of Wired magazine. I was a huge fan of this article, and I thought I'd talk with Rich today to get some of the sort of process behind putting such an article together. So, Rich Shapiro, thanks for joining me today on this recording.
Sure, my pleasure, David. Thanks for having me.
So, Rich, why don't you briefly summarize what happened with this collar bomb?
Sure. On August 28th, 2003, a phone call came into a pizza delivery shop in Erie, Pennsylvania. It was a routine call for two pizzas to be delivered to a site just outside of Erie, PA. The pizza delivery man, whose name was Brian Wells, left the pizzeria, which is called Mamma Mia's Pizzeria, and went to deliver the pizzas. About 45 minutes later, he was spotted walking into a bank with this bizarre contraption locked to his neck. He hands the teller a note declaring it a bank robbery, and the note says that this device around his neck is a bomb. The teller grabs some cash, hands it to him in a bag. He gets in his car and drives away. He doesn't get very far. About 15 minutes later, the state police find him. He's in the parking lot of an eyeglass store. And they basically surround him and pull him out of his car and kind of, you know, handcuff him. And Brian Wells says, "Listen, you know, basically, I was accosted. These people put this device around my neck at gunpoint. It's going to explode. You know, I'm not lying." And the bomb squad is called. Several minutes pass with Brian Wells sitting on the pavement, handcuffed with the device around his neck. TV cameramen show up and begin filming. So all of this is caught. It was caught on camera. And several minutes pass, and then finally this device emits an accelerated beeping noise, and seconds later it explodes, and Brian Wells passes away. For years, investigators couldn't figure out what happened here, who was actually behind this crime. And then finally in 2007, indictments were brought, and there were people arrested, and I don't want to give away the story, but the cast of characters behind the crime proved to be almost as, if not more, bizarre than the actual crime itself.
A very colorful cast of characters. It's a fascinating story. You know, just that initial incident itself could be like an entire article right there, but that's just the beginning of your piece, which is what I found so fascinating. So this happened first in August of 2003, so 7 years ago, over 7 years ago at this point. When did you first hear about it, and what drew you to this story in the first place?
Yeah, I heard about it when it happened back then. And I followed the news closely, and it was obviously a pretty intriguing and haunting crime. It received a good amount of news coverage back then. Some of the cable news channels locked on. Anderson Cooper was talking about it. Geraldo even got involved at some point. And then as the years went on, as is often with big cases like this, it was largely forgotten. And by the time the indictments were brought and people were arrested, the story, you know, was basically confined to Pennsylvania. There weren't many outlets that were still covering it. So I had been watching it basically since it happened, and just kind of following what was happening. And as, you know, I learned more about the cast of characters involved, I became more intrigued. And then it was a question of trying to figure out when was the right time for me to get involved and to write kind of a longer form piece that really captured the intrigue and drama.
And when did it occur to you that was the right time?
Right. So once it was basically a year ago or so. There was one person in prison already. Another person was, it looked like, about to stand trial. So it seems like the case was really finally coming to a close. So it was that point that I actually reached out to some of the people who had been charged with the crime, and then also went to Erie, Pennsylvania, and then started doing preliminary reporting.
Overall, I'm just curious, how many interviews did you do for this? It strikes me that I'm guessing a lot of the work for this piece went into interviews and also public records, searching through public records. Is that accurate, or am I incorrect?
No, that's absolutely correct. I would say that in all, I probably conducted close to 75 interviews. That's 75 separate interviews. And I was fortunate in that the case files were quite robust. I probably had access to 2,000 pages of court documents, which were critical for me in kind of retelling the story.
How many man hours do you think you spent both looking through public records and maybe on the story in general, if you had some estimate?
That's a good question. Tough to estimate. I would say several thousand. I'm not really sure how to...
Right. That's fine.
Even when I begin to conceive it, it's hard to actually do it in a meaningful way.
Right, yeah, definitely. And when you say 75 separate interviews, you mean with 75 separate people, is that right?
Correct. And these are friends. These are... friends of the people who were charged. These are the people who were charged themselves. I developed relationships with. This is people who worked on the case from the local people in Erie. The county coroner, people in the courthouse.
A wide variety of subjects.
Exactly.
One of the more colorful characters in the story is a character named Marjorie Deal Armstrong, who is one of the suspects and kind of suspected to be the mastermind of the whole plot. I was wondering if you can describe this person, if you feel comfortable doing that, and kind of it's very a balanced portrayal, I feel like, you write of her in the article, because it's very tough to portray her as both very disturbed, but also potentially innocent. Is that the kind of balance you tried to strike? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Marjorie Deal Armstrong could easily be the subject of her own book. I mean, I found her to be such a fascinating character that it was difficult to write a story, and keep it at 5,000 words or so, and to try to capture someone's personality who is as enigmatic as Marjorie Deal Armstrong. She's 61 years old. She basically was this brilliant student in high school, and I spoke to several of her former classmates who just talked about how incredibly intelligent she was and how incredibly knowledgeable she was back in high school. And then her mind started to unravel, and she developed bipolar disorder and a couple of other personality disorders, and this led to her basically getting into a good amount of trouble in her in middle age. She's accused of killing one boyfriend, and she's some people in Erie think that she may have killed another who died under very suspicious circumstances, her mind continued to unravel if you speak to people close to her, to the extent that she cannot stop talking. I mean, I've had several hours of conversations with her, and they're fascinating. I mean, she speaks, words flow out of her mouth with breathtaking speed, and what's, I think, most striking is she is still incredibly intelligent. I mean, I've listened to the recordings since we spoke, and I've still been impressed with how her mind works. I mean, how vast her knowledge is, and how sharp she is. But at the same time, she clearly is very troubled and has some very clear mental deficiencies.
Right. And I think the piece really is able to capture that kind of dichotomy there. Let me ask you, other than the subject matter, what was the most difficult part of putting together this story, do you think?
Sure. Great question. The story has so many turns. You know, it really is, I think, a case of truth stranger than fiction. I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up, what actually happens between these characters. And the sequencing, telling the story and trying to figure out the order of ordering the story in such a way that it makes sense and that will allow readers to follow along, it's very easy to get lost in the various bizarre events that happened after Brian Wells passed away, and actually what led to that as well. So telling the story in an organized, meaningful way that is still gripping and yet still accessible for readers, I think was one of the greater challenges. Unfortunately, and I can't say this enough, the editors I was working with at Wired were fantastic and no doubt improved the story dramatically.
You know, it strikes me that I'm sure the parallel occurred to you. I don't know if you explicitly state it in the article, but it's very similar to a premise for a Saw movie, I would think. Like, just this idea, have you seen any of the Saw films?
You know, I haven't seen any of the Saw films, but after writing it and showing it to a few friends of mine, they've said the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's
and after hearing the premise, it seems like, yeah, there are some similarities.
Yeah, like the serial killer in that movie, he's like, he wants to play a game with his subjects, so he straps some contraption on them and makes them do these ridiculous things to survive. And
right.
That's kind of how, again, I don't want to be reductionist. That's how your article begins. It's not how it ends.
Right.
But the article itself, I mean, it really reads like a movie pitch almost, complete with like twist ending. And I could almost picture like the creepy last shot of the film has already been like, it's already made right there. Did that ever occur to you when you were writing it? Have you been like approached for a movie deal? Is that something that's in your mind?
Well, while writing stories like these, yeah, you do think cinematically. Because I think that often just really makes for a lively piece if you think about it in terms of scenes and you know, plot structures mirroring films. So yes, I did think about that while I was constructing the story. And yes, I also have thought about its potential to appear, you know, on screen at some point. The story's received some interest from agents. It's not clear. These things are always pretty unclear when you start getting approached by people. You know, I've learned that it's you're better off not getting your hopes up.
Right.
But I would love to see it expanded into something larger and to be involved in some sort of project of putting it on screen. As you say, I think it has a number of very worthy qualities to it. And what I kept thinking about while writing it is its similarities to another film, The Usual Suspects. It has a little bit of that.
Oh yeah, very yeah. Good.
To it as well.
Good reference. Well, my last question, Rich, is just how do you feel? I mean, you've put this is a piece that's, I mean, been in the making for 7 years. You put thousands of man hours into it, dozens of interviews. Now it's out in the world. It's available online for anyone to read. How do you feel now that it's out there?
It's a real thrill. I'd be lying if I said it's not a big deal. You know, I've done this so many times before. It's to work so hard on a story like this, and to work on it for so long, and then to finally see it in print, and to be getting positive feedback on it. It's a wonderful feeling. I mean, it's truly exhilarating, and I've been just so thankful for the readers that have written me, you know, saying how much they like the story and just being really supportive. I mean, the Wired readers just have awed me, in fact, you know, by just their messages of support and saying, I hope to see me write again in the magazine. So it's great. This is kind of what you work for is, you know, you put in all these hours. There are times when you're writing a story when you want to tear your hair out. And then, you know, you get to this point when the story's out and people are getting you positive feedback, which is really great.
Well, I think it's a great piece. I mean, I've been reading Wired magazine for years. This is the first article that after I read it, I was like, I got to contact this guy and just tell him how awesome that article was. I think you did a great job. I hope everyone reads it. And obviously, if you're listening to this, hopefully you already have. Rich Shapiro is a writer living in New York. His newest piece, The Incredible Story of the Collar Bomb Heist, appears in the January 2011 issue of Wired magazine. It's currently available online and on newsstands. Rich Shapiro, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
David, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.